We are in Perek Tes Zayin, chapter 16, Pasuk Tes Vav, verse 15. Tonight is what, February 6th. Okay? And it is the first day of Adar Aleph. So we did the first 14 psukim last time of this Perek, and last time it was a description of all that Hashem did for us, finding us in Mitzrayim, and the mashal was that we were a young girl, a baby that was born, and without anything, we were totally defenseless, and Hashem took care of us, and then took us out of Mitzrayim. He married us, clothed us, gave us all that we need, cleaned us, gave us jewelry, everything that would be necessary. And the last thing we read in Pasuk Yudalin, in verse 14, was that we became famous amongst the nations. Now tonight, we're going to learn Mirtz Hashem the next 20 psukim, the next 20 verses, through Pasuk Lamed Dalet, through 34, which is going to describe how we then, in turn, went against Hashem, how we rebelled and rejected Hashem. And then we will stop there, and next week we'll move on to the consequences and the consolation, which is the rest of the balance of the parak. So,
what causes this rebellion?
Well, we have to read a verse.
No, I know, but I thought there always a steady stream. Is there one thing Jewish people do, or something that always sort of in contention with Hashem?
There's always one thing?
Yeah, that's focus that we read over and over and over again.
It's hard to serve Hashem. You know, lose focus, I guess. I don't know if there's one answer. Okay. I mean, if we knew the answer, then we wouldn't be where we are. So let's read through these 20 psukim. Now, the analogy is going to be for this woman that Hashem, that the man has found and helped, etc. And this woman is not going to rebel, which means she's going to commit adultery, she's going to get involved with all other types of men. Now the psukim are actually going to get fairly graphic as we go through, and I'll translate loosely when necessary. So the pasuk says, starting in Tezva 15, Vativ techibi afyeich, and you relied on your beauty, batizni al shemeich, and you were mezana, you committed adultery based on your fame, batishpechi es taznusayich al kol over lo yehi, and you poured your znus on all who passed by, to him you were, batikhi mi begadayich, and you took from your clothing, batasilach bamos tuluos, and you made for yourself, bamos means altars, tuluos means covered with these garments, meaning, so you took the material from the garments and made the bamos, made the altars beautiful. Vatizni aleihem, and you were mezana on them, lo vaos v'lo yiyeh. This should never have happened, this should never have been. Vatikhi klesi parteich, and you took your utensils of glory, mi zehavi umi kaspi, from my gold and my silver, asher nasati lach, that I gave you, vatasi lach tzalmei zachar, and you made for yourself male idols, vatizni vam, and you were mezana with them. Vatikhi es bigdei rikmaseich vatechasim, and you took your clothing, your beautiful clothing, and you covered them. I suppose that means you covered the idols. Vishami uktarti nasat lifnehem, and my oil and my incense you placed in front of them. Vamachmi, and my bread asher nasati lach, that I gave you, soles fine flour of Hashem and udvash hechaltich, and the oil and the honey that I fed you, unisati lifnehem, and you put it before them, lareach nichoach vayehi, and for them it was a sweet smell, it was a good smell. Num Hashem alakim, so says Hashem God. Vatikhi es banayach ves nosayach, you took your sons and your daughters, asher yaladet li, that you had given birth for me, vatizbochim lahem le'achol, and you slaughtered them to them, to those gods, to consume. Hama'at mitaznusayach, have you was it not enough, your idolatry, your znus, your adultery, you're going to other gods, which is the analogy of going to other men, was it not enough? And here you did even more. Vatishchati es bonai, and you slaughtered my children, vatitnim, and you put them, b'havir osam lahem, as you pass them to those other gods. Ve'ez kol tov avosayach v'saz nusayach, and all of your abominations and your znus, lo zachat es imenu urayach, you didn't remember the days of your youth, b'yosech erom ve'aryah, when you were unclothed and had nothing, you were defenseless, mizboseses b'damei chayis, you were rolling in your blood, referring back to when Hashem found us, the analogy being we were defenseless and He saved us. And it was after all of your evil, oi, oi, lach, woe, woe to you, Nu Hashem Elokim, so says Hashem God. Vativni lach gov, and you built for yourself a large tower. Vatasi lach rama b'chol rechov, and you made for yourself again high places on every street. These are places to offer sacrifices to idolatry. El karosh derech banis ramasech, on the top of every path you built your high places. Vatis avi es yafiech, and you made your beauty abominable. Vatifaski es raglayech l'chol over, and you committed adultery with anybody who passed by. Vatarbi es taznusayech, and you increased all of your znus. Vatizni el bnei Mitzrayim, and you had znus with the people of Egypt. Shcheinayech gidlei basar, your neighbors of much flesh, and you increased your znus in order to anger me. And behold, I have stretched out my hand upon you, and I lowered your fare, which means I took away some of your food. And I put you in the souls of those who hate you, the daughters of the Plishtim, hanichlamos midakech zima, those who would be shamed from your ways, from your evil ways, from your ways of zima, which means promiscuity. So here there's a reference to Hashem already starting to pull back a little bit, to take away something in order to get the Bnei Yisrael to do Teshuvah. Vatizni al Bnei Ashur, so you were mezana with the Bnei Ashur, mibilti sab aseich, that you weren't satiated, vatiznim, and you had znus with them, megambo savat, and you still were not satisfied, satiated. Vatirbi es taznuseich al eretz Kanan, kasdima, and you increased your znus to the land of Canaan towards kasdim, the gambezoslo savat, and also with this you were not satiated. Ma amuloli basech, how wayward is your heart? Nu Hashem Elokim says Hashem God, basosech es cholelu, when you did all this. Ma seisha zona shalotes, you did like the ways of a woman who is a zona, who is a prostitute, shalotes, which means here it says Moshelis, like a ruler, meaning a zona, like a not just any zona, but a zona that was well known or good at her, at what she does. Bivnosayach gabeich birosh kol derech, with your daughters on your heights on all roads. V'ramaseich asis b'chol rechov, and again your high places you made on all streets. V'lo hayis kazona v'kaleis esnan, you weren't even like a zona. You weren't even like a prostitute, lekales esnan, to get an esnan that would be something you could show off. An esnan means the payment for a zona, for her services. The Torah, although of course znus is prohibited in the Torah, but the Torah recognizes znus as a valid contractual agreement. The Torah talks about esnan zona. There's a rule in the Torah that if a woman, anybody actually, who is a zona, if a person pays a zona with whatever, let's say he pays a zona with a sheep, that sheep is prohibited to be used as a karban, as a sacrifice. Esnan zona is not allowed to be used as a sacrifice. Now, even if the zona takes the sheep and then she gives the sheep to somebody else, that person cannot use that sheep as a sacrifice. That means the Torah recognizes the sheep is being exchanged for something. So even though, of course, the act it's being exchanged for is a prohibited act, but the Torah recognizes it as a valid exchange. So here, what Yechezkel was saying is that when the Bnei Yisrael acted as a zona, they didn't even act like a regular zona, that at least would get paid for what she does with something that she could show off. Rather, as we're going to see, the Bnei Yisrael didn't even bother getting paid. Ha'isha ha'mina ofes, a woman who commits adultery, tachas isha, and instead of her husband, tikach es zarim, she takes strangers. V'chol zonos yitnu neide, to every zona they get a payment. V'at nasat es nidanayech v'chol ma'avayech, you gave your dowry to all of those who tried to take you, to those who wanted your love. So here instead you paid them. V'tishchadi osam, you bribed them, lavo elayech, to come to you, misaviv, from all around, besides nusayech, with all of your znus. V'hivach, and it wasn't you, heifach min anashim, besides nusayech, the reverse of all the women with your znus. V'acharayech lo zunan, and after you, there's no one else, no other zona like you. V'sitech esnan, and when you gave the esnan, you gave the payment, v'esnan lo nitan lach, and an esnan, a payment was not given to you, v'atihila hefach, and it was the reverse. And that's where we're going to stop for tonight. And the balance of the parak is where Hashem says, okay, because you acted like this, this is what is going to happen, and that's going to be followed with the consolation. Now, you probably noticed as we were going along here that there's a progression. The analogy is to a woman who is unfaithful, but it seems to get worse and worse as it goes on. Where it begins with simply being unfaithful, it moves on to making it like a public display of being unfaithful, building high places on the roads where it's clear and public of what this woman is doing. And then it moves on to the different nations that she is mezana with. And even when Hashem begins to pull back some of her food, so then she just switches to another nation. And finally, it moves on to that she's even worse than a regular zona, because at least the regular zona gets paid for what she's doing, and here this woman is paying them to act this way with her. So it's showing that she's even worse than a typical zona. So clearly this is not an upbeat part of the parak, and the next part is even worse. But what we still have to understand is to break this down a little bit and follow what happens. And in this way, understand a little bit better what are the pitfalls for moving away from Hashem. The progression of moving away from Hashem, and what the nuances here, the subtleties of what we did wrong. You see, the final point is that we were worse than any typical zona, because at least the zona gets paid, and here we paid others. Now, were the Bnei Yisrael truly worse than all the other nations of the world? Is Yechezkel saying that we were the worst people on the face of the earth? So we know that that's not the case, because we know that the Bnei Yisrael because we have sprinkled throughout references to how good the people were. And we've had this before. And we've had in the same sentences, in the same prakim, in the same chapters, references to how good we are and how bad we are at the same time. And historically, we know we weren't that terrible. But we also know that we are judged more with more scrutiny than other nations because of how great we are and because of how close we are to Hashem. And so here, even though this is a pretty scathing admonishment of the Jewish people, but we have to understand that the Nevi'im, the prophets, always do this, and that's typical throughout, that whatever is being said is being magnified to bring out the point. We've talked about this when we find Musar, when we find admonishment of the great ones, like when Moshe Rabbeinu is chastised, or when David HaMelech is chastised, anytime you find that, it's always meant to be understood that whatever they did was on a very subtle level, and it was something which was only wrong for them on the level that they were on, and the Navi blows it out of proportion in order to bring out what it was they did, because otherwise we wouldn't understand it. If, for instance, David HaMelech's sin with Bathsheba were explained in the Navi based on what he really did, we would say, yeah, so what? Big deal. What did he do wrong? It wouldn't mean anything to us. We would say, why does he deserve punishment? He didn't do anything wrong. It would mean nothing to us, because what he did was so subtle, was such a slight thing, and for us it would not have been a sin. It was only for him on the level he was on that it was a sin. So therefore the Navi has to explain it in a way that will make sense to us. And that's why the Navi, it says it in a way that seems like it was really terrible. That's true for all the times that the great ones are being taken to task. That's also true for the Bnei Yisrael as a whole. Because we as a whole, even though it's true we may have individuals among us, God forbid, who are truly evil, but as a whole, the Jewish people are generally good. And we are way better than anybody else on the face of the earth. There's no comparison. We're not in the same playing field as everybody else. And so the Navi can't simply talk about what the Jews did wrong, because we would say, so then why do we deserve such a horrible punishment? We deserved all this, all the death and all the suffering and the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash and the Gullus. For what? For this? So the Navi needs to magnify it to show us what the sin is. So we have to understand what is being said so that we can appreciate what was really being done wrong. So we can learn from it. That's really why it's here for us to read. Now, let's take a few examples from the beginning, going back to where we started from, which is Pasuk Tezvah 15. You relied on your beauty, and you were mezaneh, which means you committed adultery, you were immoral, based on your fame, and you poured your znus on all who passed by to him you were. So what is the Navi telling us was the root cause of the beginning of the downfall?
Pride. You think you're beautiful, you're famous, you've got it all.
Okay.
It's all about you.
Okay. Okay, so there's pride. Pride, you think you're so great, you think you're so beautiful, and you can use it for your own ends. The Pasuk says in Ha'azinu, Vayishman Yeshurun Vayivat. The Jewish people, after having so much, plenty, Vayishman Yeshurun, the Jews became fattened. It's like likened to an animal that is being fattened for slaughter. So the Jews became fattened, and then they vayivat, they rebelled. Vayivat means to kick. And over there, Rashi comments, based on Chazal, that a person doesn't rebel on an empty stomach. People rebel on a full stomach. Meaning that what he means to say is that, of course, there could be rebellions that are started by people who are starving. That's why they're rebelling, because they don't have any food. But what he means to say is that rebellion that is unjust comes from a full stomach. If I have everything that I need, I begin to feel that I'm independent. What do I need Hashem for? What do I need my provider for? I have all that I need. So I rebel. So here, the beginning is you relied on your beauty and your fame, and that's what sent you up, because you started feeling like you were all that there is. You don't need any help. You don't need Hashem. You don't need to be dependent anymore. Now, as we move on, you took your clothing and you made these bamos. You made these altars that were beautified with these clothing, and your mezana on them. This should never have happened. You took the jewelry that I gave you, the gold, the silver that I gave you, and you made them into idols, male idols, and you used them for znus. And you took the clothing, and you covered these idols, and you took my oil and my ketores, my incense, and you placed it before them. Why is Hashem referring here? The answer is obvious, but why is Hashem referring here to my gold, my silver, my clothing, my oil, my incense? What's obviously the point Hashem is making?
He's providing to him.
Okay, so you're taking that which I gave you, and you're using it for the idol. So it's not simply that you're turning away from me, but you're using what I gave you against me. Yeah. Correct. Correct. Okay. So it's not only what he gave us, but it's that which is meant to be used for serving him. So let's take that a step further. When we serve him, what do we serve him with? Gold, silver, incense, oil, etc. That's what we serve him with. Where does all that come from? It comes from him. So what are we doing when we serve him? He gives us all kinds of things. And then we turn around, we go to the Beis HaMikdash, and we say, Hashem, here is a sheep. Here is incense. Here is oil. Here is flour. So what are we giving to him? He gave it to us in the first place. Did he give it? It would be like we give our children something, and then they turn around and give it back to us as a gift. So what does that mean? Do we want it back? Okay, so it's not really for Hashem, it's really for ourselves. When we give it back to Hashem, we are showing, we understand and appreciate where everything comes from, and this is our way of understanding that. It's not, we didn't make up the way of doing it, we're following the rules in the Torah, but the symbolism of it is that we are showing Hashem that it all comes from Him, we understand it all comes from Him. When the child gives back to the parent, it makes the parent feel good, not because the parent wants it back. The parent didn't give it to the child, so the child gave it back. But it makes the parent feel good because the child is acknowledging that there is a relationship and that the child wants to be able to give to the parent, even though the child can only give to the parent what the parent gave to the child. So when you want the relationship, we're trying to establish a relationship. Here, those very items that were given to us for the purpose of serving Him, that's why He gave it to us. He gave it to us so that we can use them in our relationship with Him. We turned around and used it to forge a relationship with an idol, with an idolatry, with Avodah Zarah. But it goes further. In your test in 19, my bread that I gave you, fine flour, oil, honey, I fed you, and you put it before them as a reach nichoach, as a nice smell. So says Hashem God. So Chazal tells us over here, our sages say, and Rashi cites it, that, you know, the Jews, very soon after Matan Torah, only 40 days later, the Jews sinned, and we committed the sin of the golden calf, of the Egel Hazav. Now the Egel Hazav was a golden calf. What did the golden calf do? What's that? Well, okay. No. What did it do? Did it just stand there? I mean, it was made of gold. Okay, moved around, and the Gemara is more specific. It grazed. It ate grass. It was a golden calf. It had life to it, and it ate grass. It wasn't just an inanimate idol. It was actually moving, and it ate grass. Now, the Jewish people were serving this golden calf. So, if you're serving a golden calf, you have to feed it. So, what would they feed the golden calf? Serving gold, that makes sense. Okay. And what's that?
Mun.
Because I'll say the Jews took the mun that fell that day and put it in front of the Egel Hazav, the golden calf, to feed the Egel Hazav. Because you got to feed it, and this is our food. The food we get is mun at that time, so they needed to feed the golden calf. So if you're sitting where Hashem sits, and this happens, what ought to be the natural reaction? No more mun. The mun was a miraculous thing in the first place. It was something which was meant to be an incredible way of building a relationship between us and Hashem, that Hashem would show us this love that He showed no other nation, to give us this mun that fell from heaven, which, as we know, tasted like anything we wanted it to taste like, that had no waste, to it, meaning that we ate and did not need to relieve ourselves. The man was perfect in its nutritional value for the body. There was no waste whatsoever. And it was exactly the amount of food that we needed. It fell every day without fail. And it was available for us. And here, the Jews take that very man and feed it to this idol. So what ought to happen is that Hashem, at least the next day, there'll be no man. But the man fell the next day, and the day after, and the day after, and the day after. And it did not stop falling. The man was never withheld from the Jewish people for the entire 40 years, despite the fact that they misused it. So the incredible tova of Hashem, that He does not withhold the food from the Jewish people despite the fact that they are misusing the man. Now, think about this for a moment. I am thinking about doing a sin. I see a person and his wallet. He takes out his wallet and he leaves his wallet on the table, and he gets up and walks away for a minute. So I think to myself, I can grab that wallet and take the money out of the wallet, and no one will ever know the difference. And I'll get away with it. So that's what I'm thinking of doing. He gets up and walks away. I reach for the wallet, grab it, take out the money, put the wallet down, put the money in my pocket. Got away with a crime. Now that act is sinful. Hashem does not want me to do it. As I'm doing it, how do I have the ability to move my hand? How do I have the ability to see the wallet? How do I have the ability to think about what to do? And how do I have the ability to walk away afterwards? All of that comes from Hashem. As we know, Hashem could very easily take away any of these things, God forbid. And as I'm committing the sin, He is continually giving me the ability with which to sin. The chesed from Hashem, that He does not take away the ability to do anything based on the sin. Because really what should happen is that once I have done this, even if we'll say that while I'm doing it, He's not going to take away the ability, because then I wouldn't have free will. So He has to give me the ability while I'm doing it. But once I've done this sin, now, measure for measure, mida keneged mida, I should lose the ability to do any of these things. My hand should stop working, etc. It should all stop, because I committed a sin with the very gifts that He gave me. And yet Hashem does not remove the ability. Not unless a person goes a very long time and then finally Hashem punishes. So here, Chazal point out from these psukim that when he talks about my bread that I gave you, you put in front of those idols, they bring out the point that even as the Jews are taking the man and putting it in front of the egel hazav, still Hashem does not stop the man from happening. But take it one step further than that. And this really goes back to the question that you asked in the beginning. How could the Jews make such a mistake? How could they take the man, which comes from Hashem, and use that? Wouldn't that stop a person already? And it's one thing, I understand, a person does a sin. Okay, you know, we're all human beings. People sin. But to take something which is in itself miraculous and use that for the sin, how do we justify that? How do we understand that? Forget whether the Jews were good or bad or, you know, relative to the rest of the nations of the world. But you got to be crazy. I mean, how do we justify? Isn't that insanity to take the very miracle that Hashem does for you every day and use that for the sin?
They already committed murder. They were way past that.
But murder you do with your hands.
And you already took away a neshama that you knew that Hashem gave. I mean, all of those souls were precious souls coming out of Egypt. That was Hashem's nation. And they'd already killed Korah, who was the leader.
That's true. That's true.
Once you've committed murder, what's giving a gift to an object? I mean,
But it's more than a gift. You know, if they would have given their gold, I'd understand that better. But you know, they're giving them...
Murder is worse.
Now, I understand it's worse. But in your own mind, in one's own mind, wouldn't it be difficult, wouldn't it be take a certain, I don't know, a certain leap to move, to be able to use...
They've already taken stuff from their mothers and their sisters and their wives against the will, right? So we already kind of get the behavior there. The The Levitim are telling them, don't do any of this, it's wrong on the leaders. So when they find the leader that's going against what they want, they kill them.
Right.
I mean, it's like mob behavior way before we get to the Hegel.
Okay. Okay.
But the answer really what you're asking seems to be that the power that people have to rationalize their behavior. And so they can make something look good in their own eyes that really they know in another realm that it's evil, but the power of rationalization that they're doing, just like the Hegel and Tao, was created for a good purpose because Moshe didn't come down and they wanted another leader and all of that. That is the mechanism that
right.
we have.
Right. So
they're thinking a long time before.
What's that?
They gave up thinking a long time before. Not
acting like a pack of animals. Well, I think you have to rationalize it in your own mind. Otherwise, you can't do it. And it has to be a justification. But I think what you're saying is correct. That the rationalization, you see how far it can go. That a person can rationalize really anything. Now, it does come in stages, which is really what's being described here as well. It's not all at once that they're worse than any other zona. That it's a progression. But the way the human mind can work, and the way we can work when it comes to our Yetzer Hara, is we can rationalize really anything. And everything can happen, and anything can be okay, given enough time and enough progression to rationalize it. Yeah.
With our minds, with our mouths, with our bodies, with whatever we do, it's as if He gives us the mind and we take what He gave us, and that's just an interesting in general.
Right.
But doesn't it also say the third time you do it, it's almost like you think you're doing it the first
time? Yeah.
So they've already taken it up, they've already stolen,
you're right.
They've already killed, they've already created an idol, they've already got three. Anything after that is going to be the next one.
Okay. All right, but we're going to show another step over here. Let's go one further. Pasuk Chav, verse 20. You took your sons and daughters, share yalanat li that you bore for me, vatizbechim lahem le'echol, and you slaughtered them for those idols to consume. Hamaat mitaznusayich, was it not enough? Your znus. Vatishchati es bana, you slaughtered my children, vatitnim, and you gave them bahaviro sam lahem to pass them over to them. Now you are familiar with the form of idol worship, which is mentioned in the Torah several times, called molech. And there actually, the Gemara discusses two forms of molech, but one form or type of molech was to give a child over to the priests who ran that avodah zarah, and then that child would be burned as an offering to the idolatry, and it was typically the person would take his bechor, his firstborn, because the whole idea was he's like giving over his best to the idol. So Chazal tell us that a person had five children. And of those five children, four of them, he had them worship idols. And one of them, he had learned Torah. So of his five children, he wanted one of them to be learning Torah, and four of them were worshiping idols. And then, when the priests came to him to ask him for a child for the molech, the child he would pick would be the one that is learning Torah. That's the one he would give over. What's being said is, it's bad enough to give over any child to the molech, but to take the one child that you had designated for Torah, while the other ones were off worshipping idols, the one you pick is the one for Torah, so that's obviously exponentially worse. Now again, let's understand what Chazal are telling us over here. Does this mean all the Jews, they basically took 80% of their children and had them worship idols, and 20% were learning Torah? We know that's not the case. We know that the vast majority of people were good. Moreover, they were all giving over their children to the molech. I mean, how frequently did this happen? It wasn't a rampant problem. It happened, but it wasn't a rampant problem. So what is the issue over here, and what is being said? when it says that they had five children and four were given over to Avodah Zarah and one for Torah, so again, using the same formula that we started with, giving over to Avodah Zarah doesn't have to mean actually worshipping idols. It means that four children, the parents didn't concentrate on to get them set in the right direction. They were, you know, okay, whatever it is. And one child is what the parents put their efforts into, to have that child be the tzaddik. You know, I had a friend when I was in yeshiva, and this friend, he came from a family where the children were kind of wild. And then many years later, when I was already in Kol, so then this friend of mine's youngest brother, one of the younger brothers, came to the yeshiva, and this boy was just excellent, and he was like ate all, and he learned all the time, and he davened beautifully. So when I saw the brother later, I said, you know, what happened? Like, you know, he's not like the rest of you. He said, yeah, he's the kapara of the whole family. Right? So saying that's what's going on over here, that they would concentrate their efforts on one child. That's what they would do. Where the other ones are, whatever happened, but the one child they would really concentrate their efforts on. Now, then the priests would come and say, okay, we need a child for the Molech. So they would take this child. Now, why would they take this child? Let's understand it. Are they taking the child, they want to give over one child to the Molech. So are we going to say they're taking the one that learns Torah because the one that learns Torah is the black sheep? Really, the other ones that aren't so good are the ones they don't want to give to the Molech because they're the ones they like best. They're taking the one that's the black sheep and giving it to the Molech. That doesn't make sense, because the whole point of Molech is that they give your best to the Molech. So here the people are taking the child that they designated for Torah because they recognize that Torah is really the right thing. They recognize that this is the best of their children. This one, the one that's going in the right direction, the one that isn't succumbing to the Avodah Zarah, the one that isn't succumbing to all of the taivas, all of the desires around him, he's the one who's really headed in the right direction. That's the child that they give over to the Molech, because he's the best. So here again you see an incredible paradox. At the same moment that the parents are recognizing the correct path, they're recognizing that this is the child that they really are doing a good job with. This is the child that really is the one headed in the right direction. And they would prefer that all their children be like this one child. Yet that's the very child that they use in serving the Molech. Because the Molech gets the best. He gets the best that you have. So this is even worse than the Mun case. Because here they understand that this is the best. If it wasn't the best, they wouldn't offer him. That's why they're offering him. Why is he the best? Because he's learning Torah. So since he's learning Torah, he's the best. We'll use him for Avodah Zarah. It's a contradiction in and of itself. It's self-contradictory. The whole thought process is self-contradictory. But you see how convoluted a person's thinking process can be when they've headed down the path of chataim, of sin. You can no longer explain it away. The whole thing just becomes totally convoluted. The Gemara tells us, "Ein adam chote elein kein nichnas bo ruach shtus." A person does not sin unless a ruach, a spirit of shtus, of insanity, enters into them. This is why I always find the insanity plea to be a very difficult one to swallow. Because the Gemara tells us every sin is insane. And the reason why every sin is insane is because if we would think, a sin would be impossible, because it doesn't make sense. Now there are some that you have to think a lot before they don't make sense. But there are others which are just so obvious, and they're staring you in the face. And yet, we sin. At the very moment we could have positive thoughts, we could really have correct hashkafos, and at the same time, at the very same moment, use that very good hashkafa and use it for an avera. And that's what's being shown over here. Incredible. Now, isn't that a frightening thought? So how do you know? Isn't that frightening? So we can. They think they were doing wrong. They thought they were doing right. I mean, they were taking their best, giving to the Molech.
No, but they knew they were involved in a
Because they knew Moloch was an Avera.
They had good intentions with the Moloch? I mean, like with the Beta Egel, they said that they really had good, they didn't want to change their mind, with help of their closing Hashem or whatever. So when they served the Moloch,
okay, I understand what you're saying. It could be the Moloch was obviously a sin, but it does bring out the.
Still see the virtue of Torah because they took their
back. Right, right.
But they're still involved with
them. But to me, it's a frightening thought because you see that just because generally I'm thinking right, generally I'm on the right path, generally I've got my head in the right place, and I'm. My hashkafa, my outlook is the way it's supposed to be, generally. But there could be a flaw there. And I can miss it. What do you mean with Moshe and Aaron?
I mean, we all know Lashon Hara is wrong, and we know how terrible it is, but...
You mean with Miriam? Oh, you mean it's the thing Lashon Hara? Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
There's a few confusion, though, in this, because obviously, if man makes an idol, he controls that idol, to his behavior. He controls it in relation to the idol. But to have a Moloch, to actually give your children to burn them, I don't get the essence of it. I don't see where it comes from. What is it man is trying to do here?
Give over the best thing. I mean, when you give over a sacrifice, that's what you're doing. You're taking your own money. Whenever a person does a sin, so they bring a carbon chatas, a sin offering. Okay. So when you bring a sin offering, what you're supposed to be thinking is that cow is really me. Right, that's not a cow, it's a sheep. But that it's really me. And as it's being slaughtered, really, I deserve to be slaughtered. And my blood really deserves to be thrown on the altar. It's, when a person is supposed to understand it, is it for themselves.
So this giving of their child for death to this Moloch, is there kapara for the sin that they...
Either it's a kapara, either it's a kapara or it's a gift. Either way...
But it's so ludicrous because the Moloch, it has no essence. What's inside man that's this connection there? Especially with Jewish people on this particular time in history.
Right. So with idolatry, we have to understand that we can't relate to idolatry. We've mentioned this several times because the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah has been removed. But it was a very real desire. And the only way that we can really appreciate, and I've mentioned this before, is to understand that the Gemara tells us that the Avodah Zarah, that the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah superseded the Yetzer Hara for Gilui Arayos, for immorality. It superseded it. The Yetzer Hara for Gilui Arayos, which today is clearly, at least in terms of taiva, in terms of desire, is the greatest of all Yetzer Haras, and the billions of dollars that are spent on the industry that represents that sin that's out there. We have to appreciate that Avodah Zarah was a greater desire. And whatever amount of money is being spent on Gilui Arayos today, if Avodah Zarah would still be in existence, there would be even more money spent on Avodah Zarah. The desire is almost impossible to control, which is why they had it removed.
Expiating his sins, is that what they...
So I'm saying, we can't judge them on why they thought the idol would do anything, because that's the way the Yetzer Hara was embedded in a person. But what I'm showing you is that at the very moment that they are doing this, they're still appreciating that Torah is really the right thing and the good thing. Any hand up? No. Okay. Yeah? No? Okay. Yeah.
I mean, when we were reading this the first time, to me, it really made me sick because it was like what we're doing with the land of Israel. God gave us the land of Israel. We don't get anything back for it, but we start giving pieces of it away to the country and that to these people and whatever. I mean, we're doing it now with it. We're not any different in that sense. I mean, we're not getting anything back. We're giving away gifts, and we're doing it loudly, publicly, and with lots of fanfare and publicity. And what are we doing?
Is that our sense of wanting to control? Is there always a contention of us trying to control because God really is the overpower?
Well, I mean, that's where it starts. It starts with thinking that we're in control. I mean, that's where it begins. That we don't need God.
So, like she says, no liquidity is the leader of Israel. Right.
Right.
But,
right. I don't like focusing the talk on something which we really can't do anything about. Because what's going on in Eretz Yisrael, we really don't have any ability to change, not in a derech hateva way. Obviously, we can daven. But we can't change what's going on by any, we don't have the power to do that. We, none of us are in control over there. But even within our own, you don't have to go to Eretz Yisrael for this. Even within our own lives, I think each one of us can identify in our own lives, where at the very moment that we are committing the sin, we're also thinking positively, and we're like, it all gets convoluted in our minds. A person loses their temper. We all know when we lose our temper, it's a bad thing to do. And we may be losing our temper over a good thing. You know, why are we losing our temper? Because what we're upset about is the right thing to be upset about. But it's still wrong to lose our temper. So we're essentially saying that the fact that this is such an important thing, okay, so that justifies losing my temper. So the fact that it's so important that that this child is learning Torah, that justifies giving over to the Moloch. I mean, the whole thing is convoluted. But I think we can all find in our own lives expressions of this same type of stira, of contradiction in ourselves as we are sinning. But let's move on so we have enough time to finish the progression over here. So now he moves on to how they went to, they forgot about Hashem. When Hashem found us, this girl forgot about the man who found her when she had nothing. And it was after all, Pasuk of Gimel 23, Vahiyachari Kol Ra'asech, it was after all, you evil, Oy, Oy, Lach, woe, woe to you, Numa Hashem Elokim. Rashi says, what is the double Lashon, Oy, Oy, woe, woe? Woe about what you did, and woe, Oy, that you did not improve. It's bad enough that you did wrong, and then Oy, that you didn't do teshuva for what you did. So then he goes on with making it a public thing with these buildings. And then he starts getting into specific nations. Mitzrayim, and then the Plishtim are mentioned, Ashur is mentioned, Kinan, Kasdim, etc. And each time they are not satiated. So this is going through the various nations that the Bnei Yisrael learned from and did not reject their way of life. The first nation mentioned here in Pasuk, Chav Vav is Mitzrayim, is Egypt. Where did the Egel Hazav, the whole notion of a golden calf, where did that come from? That came from Egypt. That came from Egypt, because that was the idolatry in Egypt itself. As you've heard last year when I spoke about Pesach, Egel Yefefiel Mitzrayim, Egypt is compared to a beautiful calf in the Pasuk in Yirmiyah. And that's because the Malbim says they used to worship the calf. And so that's where it came from. That Egel Azav came from there. It moves on to the Plishtim, which is when we got to Eretz Yisrael, and we were influenced by the Plishtim. We were influenced, which Plishtim live right on the border of Eretz Yisrael, that is where the Gaza Strip is, where the Plishtim historically were. Then comes Ashur, the Assyrians, up in northeast of Eretz Yisrael. And then finally, moving on, even though it says Kenan, this is a difficult reference, in Pasuk Chav Test 29, but Tiberius Test Nesech, Alaret Kenan. Kenan was where they lived. So what do you mean they went to Kenan? And the Mepharshim struggle with how to translate this word Kenan. Kenan can also mean merchants or traders. It doesn't have to mean the land, the people of Kenan. But leaving that aside, Kasdima, Kasdim, that is Babel. That's ultimately who destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. Ashur are the ones who took the 10 Shvatim, the 10 tribes, into Golus. And Kasdim are the ones who destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. That's Babel, Nebuchadnezzar, and took the rest of us into Golus. Now, what seems to be what Yechezkel seems to be saying over here is that it's not coincidental that it is Ashur that took the Aseres HaShvatim, took the 10 tribes, and that it was Kasdim that eventually took the rest of us. It seems that the Jews' preoccupation with the way of life of Ashur and the way of life of Babel of Kasdim, that predated the attack of Ashur and of Kasdim. Meaning that it is precisely because the Jews were so enamored with Ashur that Ashur then came, as we'll see later next week, that Ashur came and took the 10 Shvatim into Golus. It is because we were so enamored with the Kasdim, with Babel, which is why they came and took us into Golus. It seems that the nation themselves that came and attacked us and defeated us was a response to our being so involved with them. And finally we move on to this, to the point that we started with, which is that in the end we are shown to be worse than a regular Zona. Because a regular Zona at least gets paid for what she does. And here, the Jewish people not only didn't get paid, but actually paid others to act in this way. Now, how do we understand that? This is supposed to be the worst of the worst. So how do we understand this last step of not only did we not get paid, but we paid others?
Cultures around us, hoping that we're going to be like them and get them to like us better. Are they looking for the same thing?
Okay, good.
Okay,
so that's good. That's one thought, that the people around us really were rejecting us, and the only way we could get them to be interested in us was to give to them. And with the this is obviously, as we all know, an old mistake of the Jewish people to think that the more that we are like them, the more they will like us. The more we give to them, the more they will like us. The more they'll do good for us. And in the end, we all know that it's the reverse. The more we're like them, and the more we try to show them that we are with them, the more they reject us and push us away. How about within the analogy itself? This woman, rather than being paid for what she does, she had to pay others for what she's doing. Okay. So the sin gets to the point where the value of this sin is the sin itself. Where until this point, the reason for the sin is because of the desire. There's a desire, and in order to satiate or fulfill the desire, the person sins. That's in order to get something out of it. The Chazal tell us that in the time of Bilam, when Bilam gave the Benos Moab and Midian, gave the daughters of Moab and gave Moab and Midian the Eitzah, the advice that if you want to get the Jews to be punished by Hashem, get them to worship idols. And so what they did is they had their daughters go and entice the Jewish men, and then as the daughters were enticing the Jewish men, they got the men to bow down to the idol. So the Gemara tells us that Lo Avdu Yisrael Avodah Zarah, the Jews only worshipped the idols because of the znus, because of the girls. That's why they worshipped the idols. The Jews weren't really interested in the idols. They were interested in the girls, but it was the only way to get to the girls. So that's the way the sin begins over here. It begins with, it's not that the Jews want the particular sin, but the Jews want something out of it. There's something to gain. There is recognition. There is whatever taivas, whatever desires can be fulfilled that can be gotten from the nations, etc., that the Jews want. But it becomes an obsession to the point where even though they're not getting anything out of it anymore, not only are they not getting anything out of it anymore, they have to pay to get it. Still, it becomes an end in and of itself. It becomes value in and of itself. It's an addiction, exactly like an addiction. It's exactly what's being described over here. Where it gets to the point where the person knows they're hurting themselves. The person already knows, I'm not getting anything out of it anymore. It's not even that much fun anymore. It's not that much enjoyable anymore. But I have to do it. I have to have it. And it's worth it even though it hurts me to do it. That's how far the sin goes. And in that respect, sin is very much like an addiction. And that's really the Gemara which you brought up before, that the Gemara says when a person does an Avera, if he does it two times, then it becomes permissible. And if he does it three times, it becomes like a mitzvah. It becomes that which he must do. Obviously, it's not really a mitzvah, but in his own mind, it becomes something which he's got to do. And the comparison to an addiction is very, very true. That's what an avera becomes. So what we started with, that it began with, we were beautiful, and we had everything, we were famous, so there's a sense of rejection of Hashem. I can go out on my own, I can strike out on my own, and I can get what I need without Hashem. And then that, the progression, goes all the way down to the point where I'm not getting what I need. In fact, I have to give away more in order to get that which I started with, but it's worth it anyway. It's worth it. The whole reason for everything has been forgotten. Not unlike a child who throws a tantrum and then eventually forgets why they're having a tantrum in the first place. They're just having a tantrum, and that's it. That's the way the averos work. It gets to the point where the averos are just averos, and there's no rhyme or reason for it anymore. The whole motivation is gone and isn't being fulfilled, but it's irrelevant, because the goal is the Avera in and of itself. And that's the final point, which will move us on to next week.
So at that time, the righteous people thought this is so mixed up and so convoluted that the Mashiach was, they thought it was part of Mashiach, time factors in
there. I don't know. No. Maybe later we'll see. I don't know. Now, when we meet with Hashem next week, so we're going to try to finish the parak next week. As I said, it's going to now get to the consequences, which is always the worst part of it, where Hashem's going to describe all the negative things that are going to happen to the Jewish people. But there is going to be some consolation. And as we go through it, remember that what we saw tonight was, although described as horrible, but you see that there is some good sprinkled throughout the whole thing. And a lot of it is this convoluted thought that's going on. And let's see how that plays out as we move on to finish the parak, and I hope next week we'll do that.